T.C. Boyle has a new book out. It's stories, too. And look at the heft of this book. These are just the second bunch of them. It's out right now, and he's on with the phone list from Santa Barbara, California. T.C. Boyle, ladies and gentlemen. How are you, Tom?
Well, just fine, Michael. Good to hear your voice again.
And yours as well. It's pretty darn early out there, though, and I'm sorry to do this to you again.
It's my joy, but I keep waiting for the show to fly me and my entourage of retainers out so I can be on stage live with you.
Well, how many does that include, then, with the entourage and the retainers?
That's 36, including my mother-in-law and the dog.
Now, I was this. By the way, I'm really enjoying this. And I've read a lot of these before, actually. You know, I have a subscription to The New Yorker, so I've read many of them before. But this saves you, like, 20 years of New Yorker subscriptions to get this book.
Well, after all, you know, in the era of e-books, the holidays are coming up, and people like to have an actual thing to give one another. And this is a massive tome of 915 pages.
Yeah. Are you ever intimidated by how much you've written? Are you personally?
The problem, Michael, is every time I have an idea for a story, I'm very excited for about 30 seconds, and I realize I've already written it. So I don't know.
But that's never stopped you.
Will it be a third volume?
That's never stopped you before, though. That's what I like about it.
No, you know, again, my mom and dad taught me to have a good work ethic, and I have a long commute from the bedroom through the bathroom into my office every day.
I know another story. Another story on a wild animal in the wrong place in an urban setting.
Oh, there are many of them. Yes.
Did you ever think about
them in here?
Did you ever think about that? But I understand.
Yes, I have.
I understand you now. I understand you now because I read that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Does that pretty much say it?
It says it all for me.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, that means that the individual is a representative of the entire race.
Okay. Can you give me illustrations and compare and contrast? Oh, this is not a final exam. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, back to the wild animals.
Yes.
You know me well over these years. I write about anything that catches my fancy in any mode. And so, for instance, a couple of years ago, there was a tiger attack at the San Francisco Zoo. And I did extensive research by going up and looking into the pit. And the pit was 12 and a half feet from the base to the top. And it's supposed to be 16 by industry standards. And when those three young fellows on Christmas Day a few years ago harassed the tiger was able to get out and get a little bit of revenge. And so I wondered, what does that mean? And so I wrote a story called Burning Bright, and it's one of the new ones in here.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's not the only one with tigers in it, right? Is that one? Is that the one with the old lady in the yard in the fence?
Oh, that's one that has a special delight for Wisconsinites. It takes place both in L.A. and in Wisconsin, where a few years ago there was a proposition to eliminate all house cats that are found out of doors as nuisance animals, just to shoot them.
That was for real, huh?
It didn't. No, this is for real.
I question 62.
But the kitty lovers arose, you know, and of course they were backed by, I suppose, by the kitty litter manufacturers too.
Yeah, and this is this peculiar thing in California where they have all these questions on the ballot that are somebody's bad idea, and people actually get to vote on bad ideas.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to alienate the 97% of my audience who do have and love cats. I will say though that these are invasive animals that are doing a real job on our native birds.
Yeah, well, I mean,
love your kitty, but keep him inside and make sure he has plenty of mashed fish heads to eat, so he doesn't have to go out and kill all the birds outside.
Exactly. Well, I love that story. Question 62, and then the character in there, one of the characters in there, wonders what question one might have been in California. The first question they put on the ballot.
Yes, well, she presumes it's wipe out the Indians.
Yeah, that was question one. Should we wipe out all the Indians?
Right, and by now we're up to question 62. Should we wipe out the kitties?
I've been working on my review of your tome here, and I got a very short one.
I hope it's... Go for it.
I think you'll like this. It's a tour de force, farce, and fresse.
What is the fresse part?
Fresse is eating.
Oh, really?
Because your characters are fixing food or have these little dishes that, right in the middle of the action, they'll be fixing something homemade duck sausage with fennel or something in the middle of some apocalypse.
Just like in real life. And by the way, I have to add to your review, Fress. And how about Fress?
Okay.
Have I got you? Have I stumped you on Fress?
Fress, yeah.
Fress is the excrement of the little caterpillars that are denuding our trees. There's little pills. So add that in, too.
Not for the review, though. This is good. The three, don't you think? Forest, Farce, and Fress. I thought it was pretty.
Yes.
Or Asiago and brown nut bread or whatever, those little sandwiches. But isn't it true that your characters tend to stop whatever the action is and fix themselves something a little upscale at any given moment?
You know, some of the stories, of course, are very funny, but others are straightforward, realistic, dramatic pieces. But in any case,
people got to eat.
In real life, we do tend to eat three times a day if we're very lucky. And so, yes, preparing food is a big part of it.
Yeah. And there's usually an apocalypse looming. That's another thing that's right. I mean, life is waiting for an apocalypse, or not waiting for it, but it happens anyway.
Yeah, I mean, especially living here in California, where we have, serial killers, and we have floods and fires and earthquakes daily. It makes me a little nervous, and so yes, I do tend to address apocalypse a lot in my stories.
Yeah. Do you have any conclusions about it after addressing it?
I think we're in deep trouble, all of us. And again, I hear your audience laughing. I wish I were there to see how beautiful they are and responsive. But I must say that I don't want to bum anybody out on a Saturday morning, but death comes for us all.
Yes. No, that doesn't bum anybody out. I do have one for the apocalypse, too, and part of this review that I'll never write, about the apocalypse of the quotidian. Do you like that?
I like that. I like that.
You can use it if you want.
Well, thanks. I think I'll part four of the book will come out next year, and I'll call it Apocalypse of the Quotidian.
Yeah.
And in your honor.
Let me ask you this. Would you ever travel to Greater Stuyvesant or wherever for a $250 check and a plaque?
Well, you're referring to the story of the Marlboro Man Manchester Musser Award, in which a writer, sort of a young fellow about my age, gets an award for $250 and goes to Greater Stuyvesant, which is north of Albany. Although I invented this town, so I guess I have to say that I was born and raised there, and I go there every day, but it doesn't really exist. No.
You've never done that? You know, how much? What's the minimum for you to get you?
$251. $251, Michael. That'll do it. Actually, I have to say that normally when we talk, I've been on tour. I've been on tours almost continuously since September 7th. Finally, I'm home and looking forward to cleaning up after my wife, the poor woman. When I'm not home, there's no one to clean up after her. She is, by the way, asleep at this very moment.
Yeah. As well, she should be. Which kind of reminds me of the story of that musician who was found dead and decomposed in his house, which is grown over with trees and vegetation. That really struck me, that one. I don't know why, somehow I identified with that guy ending up that way.
This is a story called Sic Transit, as in Sic Transit Gloria Mundi, so go the glories of the world.
Yeah.
And, we're living in a nice neighborhood here in Santa Barbara, and big houses, all of that. And one house, you couldn't see it. It was just completely overgrown, and you could peek down the driveway, and there was an old American car listing to one side. And I said to my wife, I suppose some old person lives there. Soon they'll be dead, and they will remove everything. I was too optimistic. Yes, of course, they died. Bulldozers came in and took this person's life, whatever it was, photo albums, the automobile, everything, every blade of grass, every tree, everything, right down to the bare lot so you could have your ocean views. Mm-hmm. And now some new mansion is there. Yeah. This is the way of the world.
Yeah. Well, that was enough for you, the idea of that house overgrown, to put someone in there for your own purposes.
Yes. Yes, and the narrator is very curious, a guy not entirely like me, but, someone who happens to walk by once in a while, and he couldn't resist after he heard of this tragedy of going into the neighbor's house and seeing what was there.
Yeah, I love that story. I'm not sure why, but I do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And then, there's a lot of bad dates in your stories. I've noticed that, But maybe no worse than those two people after the total apocalypse, like almost the two people left on Earth. They get together and they don't get along at all.
After the plague. Isn't that the way it always is?
I imagine the way it will be, yes.
Mm-hmm. I haven't been on a date for about 70 or 80 years now since I first met my wife. And the best material that I could ever come up with is completely forbidden to me. And this material is her family and previous girlfriends. So, yeah, it's not always easy.
Yeah, not easy. But I love the part that there are two people left on Earth, basically, or it seems to be that way. And she says...
Male and female.
Yeah, and she says to the guy, "You're no Howard."
Right.
You know, because I feel that's
exactly... This is one of the older stories in the book, and it goes back to 98. I was meditating on the coming plague. I had just read Laurie Garrett's wonderful book, The Coming Plague, in the late 90s, about how all the microbes are breeding up to take advantage of this food resource we're presenting them on our airplanes every day. And I just wondered, some people would obviously escape it. And in my case, this one guy is isolated in a cabin in the woods. And one of the people who survives was in one of these deprivation chambers, you know, where you go inside and they lock you in for a given period of time. But, of course, once everybody dies, if electricity goes off, you don't know how long you're in there.
It's perfect. It was made for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, that's what I'm asking for the holidays for my wife, is a deprivation chamber in the basement.
My life already is a deprivation chamber. I don't actually need it. And then another great example of you seizing on something, just the winds on Shetland Island.
Oh, yes.
That must have just...
This is a story called Swept Away.
Swept Away. That's
and
a great
I had read that, you know, the Shetland Islands are the windiest place on Earth. And I wondered, what is that like? Well, cats blow off roofs and strike people in the back of the head. Pots fly down the street. Children go flying down the street. And so, of course, I made it into a love story. And incidentally, here's the power of fiction.
Yeah.
It appeared in The New Yorker, and I then heard from the editors of the Shetlander magazine in the Shetlands, wondering when I'd live there and for how long. And I had to confess up that I'd never been there, but I had once been to Oban off the Arctic coast of Scotland and nearly froze to death on a fishing boat. So that was all I needed to write that story, which, by the way, the Shetlanders... reprinted in the Shetland magazine. I'm very proud of that.
I did. Is it true about the 500 pounds of coal people carry in their minivans for ballast?
Yes, it's true, actually. Everybody carries a weight in their cars to give them ballast in these high winds.
Now I'm wondering, I know we broached this before, do you feel like you might care to read just a bit from one of these stories so we can actually...
I'd love to read you the first paragraph of My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain.
Great story. Please do.
I like my wife fine, and we had a pretty smooth run of it over the years, but there was a sort of, what do I want to say here? Expectedness to the days that sometimes bore down on me till I felt like a piece of furniture that hasn't been moved in a lifetime. An end table, maybe, made of maple, with some fine beveling that serves no other purpose than to collect dust. Which is why, and I'm not making excuses, just stating the facts, I pulled on my black jeans and turtleneck that night, dug my ski mask out of the closet, and climbed up the backside of Lily Barron's cabin to the patch of roof where the deck projects on the second floor, and peeped in the window, with no other intention but to see what she was doing at 11:45 at night, and maybe, if that was what she wanted, to surprise her, give her a little jolt, in the best possible sense, that is, by way of amiability and with the promise of mutual enjoyment.
That's a good paragraph.
Thank you, my dear fellow. I have to say, here is the way this story came to me. You know that I spend a lot of time up in the Sierras, in the Sequoia National Forest. I rent a little house in a very small community, 28 people.
Yeah, big
Somebody
timber.
Walks by the door. Yeah. I know their first, middle, and last name and everything they suffered in elementary school. Mm-hmm. Anyway, a new couple moved in, whom I never met, by the way, in case there are any lawyers in the audience. And this precisely happened. These were religious people who pontificated about Christ and so on. And meanwhile, after a drunken party, the male of this group went home and did precisely this, put on his black ski mask and climbed up and peeped in the window at one of the other people, women, who had been at the party.
Yeah.
And was unmasked, of course, unmasked and humiliated, tracked down by the locals. Everyone, by the way, the rule of the mountain is everyone must have 20 guns. So they all got their 20 guns out and unmasked this guy. And I just wondered, where do you go from there?
Yeah, yeah. And it's unexpected, of course. But life gives you gifts, doesn't it, all the time. It's amazing. So they gave you this big timber, this place called Big Timber, the place where everyone calls their house a cabin, no matter what it is.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. And ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, I guess, is what it goes to show you.
I suppose, yes.
Yeah. That's a great story, by the way. I love it.
Well, thank you so much. You know, Michael, this will come as a surprise to you, but a lot of people, not, of course, in your audience, but a lot of people don't really have much of a sense of humor and don't often get what I'm doing here with these funny stories, because they are, you know, there's always this sort of the bleak punchline to this. My pain is worse than your pain.
Yeah. And life is a series of painful experiences.
Right. And of course, on a more serious note, it is impossible to relate to anybody else's pain. I met a guy recently whom I'd known in college. I hadn't seen him in many years. And we were sitting around with two other guys, and he said, you know, Jesus, this Percodan isn't doing anything for me. And by the way, he was drinking a Long Island iced tea at the time. And I said, well, what's wrong? And the other two guys just made these shushing noises, because if he were begin to tell us, we'd still be there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like
it's easy for us to laugh because, you know,
it's not us.
We can still walk. That's right.
That's like all the wrecks that I've crawled out of, which is another one I totally relate to. Although, you know, we've all crawled out of wrecks, and eventually we get one we don't crawl out of, you know, so that's sort of life.
Yes, thank you. All the wrecks I've crawled out of is a story about a close friend of mine who butted his head up against the universe every day as a young man, especially just to find out just how hard his head was. And he was an abuser of drugs and alcohol and automobiles. And there were many wrecks in his life, both literal and figurative.
Yeah.
But he survived them.
Yeah. But the emotional ones were the tough ones.
I think so. I mean, that's what the story is about, actually. He winds up after one drunken escapade in which he flips his car and walks back the dark road to the house that he lived in with his girlfriend. But he was so drunk that he'd forgotten that they'd broken up 6 months ago, and no one was going to answer the door.
No. Right.
I guess there's a lesson there. It's either
did your friend read the story?
Don't wreck your car, don't be drunk, or don't have a girlfriend, or all three.
Yeah, or any of those things. But I do, you know, and I like the fact that everything should be expected in life. I mean, all these things that happen to you should expect them, but you don't. You can't really believe they're going to happen. So
one of the beauties of fiction, Michael, and in films that we see, is that we can have the vicarious thrill of imagining the worst. But as we say, I mean, in that moment, it is not happening to us.
Yeah.
But it's coming.
Yeah. So I mean, it's the going out with your fly rod and your pack, and ending up with a bear frolicking with your corpse.
Yes, that's
story.
Also in My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain, the heroine of the story. That's her late husband. Broke his leg. That's right. The bear frolicked with his corpse.
Yeah.
But he did have the solace of a pint of bourbon, which he drank while he lay there in the woods fighting off the ravens, who are the first to come.
They pecked his eyes out. Yes.
They pecked your eyes out, yes.
Yeah. Well, what's unrealistic about that story is he did not finish the bourbon.
Yeah,
that seems unrealistic. So, just in general, now I wonder, stories are different from novels. All right, Tom's there for that's a brilliant statement. I took a course.
You may know that as a student in the Iron Writers Workshop. Yeah. I exclusively wrote stories. I did that for 5.5 years. I got my PhD at Iowa also. And I had three teachers there, Vance Bergeli, John Irving, and John Cheever.
Yeah.
Vance and John Irving only wrote novels. Cheever mainly wrote, or was better at writing stories than novels. And also Ray Carver was in town at that time and became a friend of mine. And as we know, he only wrote stories. And I said at one point to John Irving, well, you know, I think I'm going to be like Ray and be content just to write stories. Mm. And he said, well, you may change your mind. And so when I finished the PhD, I did, and I wrote Water Music, this massive 500-page novel.
Yeah.
And I realized that it's all the same. They're all stories, whether they're 5 pages or 15 or 500. It's just a question of complexity of the plot.
Mm. But
so I don't really make that much distinction, except that I do write stories in a given period and novels in a given period and set out to do that purposefully.
Do you write them simultaneously?
No. Only one after the other. I just finished a novel before I went off on tour. It's called The Harder They Come, and it's about American violence. Where is it coming from? Why, for instance, does it seem that every schizophrenic in America must have automatic weapons?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to resolve that question. And now that I've finished that, I'm trying to think of some new stories again. Mm-hmm. Anybody has some ideas for me, I'm willing to take them, use them, and profit off them.
All
can
right,
I tell you a quick anecdote about this, Michael?
Please.
So my book that is set in Battle Creek, Michigan, The Road to Wellville, about Dr. Kellogg, came about in this way. A friend who was a filmmaker who worked for Ted Turner for many years said, you will love this book. And it was the book The Nuts Among the Berries by Ronald M. Deutsch, A History of the Health Food Movement. And he said, there are many cranks in here. It'll be right up your alley, but please don't write about Dr. Kellogg. I want to make a movie about him. And I said to my friend, Kevin, no problem. But as I began to get into this, I realized that Kellogg was my man. So finally I had to call Kevin and say, Kevin, so look, I'm sorry, bad news. I am going to write about Kellogg. But when the book comes out, you will get a fat. And he said, check. And I said, no, credit. And so he did.
I know, because you can't really patent ideas, can you?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Right. But, of course, you can lose friends.
Yes. Did you hear from the Kellogg people versus the Post people?
Not really, but... No. When I first went to Battle Creek to do research, I poked around the library and some of the streets and the cemeteries and so on. The Kellogg Corporation would not even let me in the door, and I think wisely so, very wisely so. And I hadn't, I didn't know even what I was going to write about.
Yeah. That was an amazing book. I love that book.
Well,
it's so American. You know, it's so much like Americans, like this competition for the perfect cornflake. Whatever, and this whole rage for cornflakes all of a sudden. It was so American, you know.
Well, what is wonderful, this is the turn of the last century, is that the health food movement continues today. We just have fancier names for it. For instance, Dr. Kellogg's enema machine, because he felt you must have a clean digestive tract. You can simply see the ads in the back of Harper's for the high colonic wash. I mean, it's the same thing. We all want to be healthy. We all want to live forever. You mentioned in your monologue the handful of nuts,
Yes, handful of nuts.
Now I'm damn sure to eat a handful of nuts every day, and I wonder if two handfuls would make me even healthier.
Or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Possibly. In Yiddish, it comes out a little different, but it's I understand what you're saying here. And and what a gift California! Coming to California was like the biggest gift of all, because this is a state that has every possible apocalyptic situation. And because mudslides are Tortilla Curtain, one of the earlier books is really based on this mudslide. Where actually one world slides into the adjacent world that they know nothing about, and it's an amazing book. But it's all
well. Thank you.
What a gift California is.
It has been. Life takes us in ways and places we can't foresee. So, for instance, I was reflecting with my wife recently about this. I had never been west of the Hudson River before I went to Iowa, and I'd never been to California before I came to L.A. to teach at USC.
Yeah.
There were three places at which I could have gotten a job. USC got in there first. I came to California, and as a fish out of water, I've been able to look at it in a way that native Californians don't really. It's given me lots of material. Now, one of the places that I really wanted to go to was University of Minnesota at Minneapolis. And had I gone there, of course, I could have written the great books about the Swedish immigrants of the 1890s instead of the Mexican immigrants of the 1990s.
That's true. That's true. Or Fargo. You could have wrote Fargo.
I could have written Fargo. What a wonderful thing. Yeah. The Coen brothers are my heroes. They are wonderful. I look forward to their new one coming out soon.
Yeah. Can you keep those fresh eyes now that you're part of the problem out there in California?
I hope so. I hope so, because I'm not, you know, exclusively wedded to California. When we talked last, of course, it was over my book San Miguel, mm-hmm. about San Miguel Island, and the one that preceded it, When the Killing's Done, is about Santa Cruz Island, right off the coast here of Santa Barbara. So, and of course, the new one I've just told you is set in Northern California, the one about violence. So I suppose I'm part of the problem, but I'm trying to work things out.
Yeah, but you know what I mean, like. Kaczynski came here, and he could look at the country in different, or, you know, with eyes that weren't from here, so he could actually see what was going on. That was an advantage.
But, I guess then since I'm so inured to California, I guess I'll just have to start writing about Wisconsin, for instance.
Wisconsin
or
does
my
appear.
Home turf of New York.
Yeah, Wisconsin does appear. I've noticed Wanakee is involved in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
That's a little known reference, although it's the only Wanakee in the world that's right down the road down here. But it was nice
Well, you know that,
nice to see that.
I have been many times to Madison, a town that I love. I did research there twice.
For the Wright
one,
book.
For the Frank Lloyd Wright book, yeah. The Women. And it's, and for the McCormick book, the first book I wrote here, Riven Rock, about Stanley McCormick. The McCormick family papers are at that wonderful library in downtown Madison. It's a good place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Wanakee is nearby, so that's convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there, I think there's a reference to those two women who got off the bus and looked like they were from somewhere in Wisconsin. Looked like they were from Wisconsin, I think you said.
Well, that's, you
from
got
Oshkosh.
Me there.
Looked like they were from Oshkosh, that's what you said.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that one, yes. Yeah. Well, that is Three Quarters of the Way to Hell, A Christmas Story. This is one in which I often wondered, you know, we're coming to that season now. You hear these same... I'm sorry, corny old Christmas songs recorded in the 50s, you know, by Frank Sinatra and so on. I often wondered, you know, who were these people recording these songs and where were they really so pure? And so I imagined a singer down on his luck, a male and a female singer, going to the studio to record a Christmas side and what became of them. And, of course, I'm... From their perspective, yes, of course, we would use that terminology of the 50s, like they got off the bus from Oshkosh.
Yeah, widely known phrase.
Yes.
And, Corey, that was the story that featured the second trumpet with Mitch Miller, I thought was a classic reference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the joys of writing a story set in the 50s is to try, it's a third-person point of view. So it's from the point of view of the guy, the singer, and the female singer, and to be in their minds and to... use phrases and references that might be natural to them, but without imposing it on the story so much. Mm-hmm. I knew about Mitch Miller because my parents would watch his show on TV when I was a kid. And, of course, this was anathema to me. I would go directly upstairs and put the speakers on either side of my head and play Jimi Hendrix.
Well, it's intimidating. Because there's so much that's good here that this will never be duplicated again by anyone, I think. And this is just half of it. This is stories. There is a stories, right? And this is stories
this
two.
Yeah, the T.C. Boyle stories came out in 1998. This is T.C. Boyle stories two.
Yeah.
It's 1,600 pages of stories. They're something you can... I love stories by others, you know, not just by myself, to read through, because if you don't like one, you go to the other, or you read them casually, you read them before you go to bed.
Yeah.
There are a lot of them. I don't know, Michael, given the fact that I've revealed to the audience that death comes for us all, whether or not there will be a third volume. But I'm feeling good, and I hope so.
I did read one reviewer who put it in context of, well, he's 64 years old now. This is putting, like, his life in order. That's not what it's about, is it? I mean, you're still at the height of your powers, and that's a stupid way to approach anything, I think.
Well, I love your saying that, but I guess I'll have to ask my doctor about that.
Yeah. And there's probably a story in that, too, really, depending upon his reply.
Well, it is a kind of legacy. I've got all these stories. I want them to be there for whoever might want to be interested now or in the future. And I hope to continue writing them and be productive, because if you're not productive, then you're dead.
Yeah. The prolific is another thing, though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a heavy responsibility, being so prolific? I would think so.
Yes, but as I said, you know, if you work 7 days a week at something, eventually it accumulates.
That's quotable. And I'm sure there'll be a Stories 3. T.C. Boyle, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks,
from Santa Barbara. Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.